So let's make a start. So what I want to do is sort of have an overview of cyber and the types of cyber attacks and cyber crime that's happening at the moment. So starting off with, well, who are these baddies? Well, they come from a variety of areas. People just seem to think, oh, it's kids in hoodies, you know, hacking, but it's not. It can be organized crime. We can have things like state-sponsored, which is potentially behind a lot of the ransomware attacks that have been happening at schools over the last couple of weeks. Insider threats, so that's somebody within your organisation, within your law firm, who has, in a fit of pique, decided to do something. Script kiddies, that doesn't mean children. What that means, it means a usually a more inexperienced hacker who's using a pre-existing programme. And executing that program. And then we've got hacktivists, and these are the sort of, they portray themselves as being sort of the Robin Hoods of this world, the group Anonymous. They would go and, based on their, where they feel morally right, attacks on things like ISIS, for example. Now, the government has seen that cyber is one of the biggest threats to the UK and are investing an awful lot of funding in the things like the National Cyber Security Centre. So I would strongly recommend, if you need any help with cyber, that you go and check out that the National Cyber Security Centre, because there's a huge amount of really useful information. Okay, so what's this common cybercrime, and what's the most prolific cybercrime that's going on out there at the moment? Without a doubt, it's ransomware. So those of you that might not be familiar with ransomware is where malware has been executed, and I'll talk about how it gets executed in a minute, on a system, and everything is encrypted, and usually a note appears on all the machines, as in a ransom note, demanding payment for the key to decrypt the data so you can get your data back. In a nutshell, that's what it is. And there's lots of different sophisticated types of ransomware out at the moment. So one of the common questions we get asked is, if anybody was subject to ransomware, would you pay the ransom? Well, the answer is, it kind of, the police will always tell you never pay the ransom, but it depends. What's happening a lot at the moment is that there's some quite a lot of ransomware out there which has quite a relatively low ransom, so a few hundred pounds. But when you see that that's been executed on many, many organizations, that, you know, they're making a lot of money, but as far as the business is concerned, then potentially they can get their data back. But you have to say to yourself, am I going to negotiate with these, which are effectively dishonest criminals who have no honesty or integrity? A few reasons why you will always be recommended from the police and the National Crime Agency never to pay the ransom is that you're not sure that they're actually going to give you the key to decrypt your data. They may have planted something else, so they may have actually put something through a back door, and you'll get attacked again, and also you're open for future attacks. And there's also this something called ransomware as a service, which, believe it or not, so software as a service is, are things that you subscribe to. So when you, for example, we use a CRM called Zoho, and you pay a monthly subscription fee, that's called software as a service, because you sort of like pay as you go. So it's commoditized ransomware. Believe it or not, you can actually have ransomware as a service with dashboards, ratings to actually attack organizations. Lots of ransomware, relatively low skills needed. It's been absolutely rife in the education sector. So my son's school in Manchester, they were a victim of ransomware, and they were down for a good 10 days. It took everything out, the whole systems, phones, the lot, and they were ringing up the headmistress, being really quite nasty, asking for payment and so on, which they weren't. They got forensic people in to fix the issue. One of the things that the ransom, the criminals are doing, is not just encrypting your data, but taking that data and holding you to another form of ransom. Is okay, you've got two choices. You decrypt your data and you pay the fee, otherwise we'll publish all your data. So it's called double extortion. And sometimes backups are useless, because in examples where they've used double extortion, they may have already been in the system and encrypted, put something in that will encrypt your backups. So ransomware, like I said, absolutely rife at the moment. Another common cybercrime at the moment is what's called business email compromise. That's where somebody's got into your email, which is relatively easy because people sometimes don't change their passwords, and they're relatively easy to access. And they will look for something, an email which with, let's say, an invoice, and doctor that invoice and send that out, which is called invoice hijacking. And this is something that originated in conveyancing in solicitors' offices. the invoice is doctored, it goes out to an individual, an organization, and that organization, the bank details have changed. They change the bank details on their system, they pay the invoice, and lo and behold, the money doesn't go to the person who's raised the invoice, it goes to the criminals. And there's been a lot of social media hacking of accounts. Obviously, from a personal perspective, that can be a nuisance, but from a business perspective, taking over your social media accounts can have could have a detrimental impact to your organization and its marketing. One of the ways that the cyber criminals are doing that is what's called bypassing two-factor authentication. So two-factor authentication is when you have two things to log in, so a password and also something else. Now, in law firms, you may have like a little tag or a little app on your phone, which has a number in it that generates a number and you tap that in. And that's sort of a secondary layer that ensures that systems are kept secure. Now, they use two-factor authentication for when you change your password, let's say, for example, on social media accounts. So you may get a phone call from somebody purporting to be from that provider saying, oh, no, we are that provider because you're about to get a PIN number. If you could give me that PIN, then, you know, you'll know that we are whoever they claim to be. Actually, what they're doing is they are changing your password. So they're changing the password and the two-factor authentication code, which would come to you that you would usually type in, you've given to the criminals and then they're in and then off they go. So that's happening an awful lot. In terms of social media compromise, things like setting up and selling goods or contacting people in your contacts list saying, oh, I've lost my wallet. Can you just transfer £5 for me? That happens an awful lot. But without doubt, when businesses today in Manchester, the biggest risk is ransomware. So how does that ransomware get in? Well, I've nicknamed this Sea a Little Fishy. It's, I would say, the majority of the time's down to phishing. So phishing with a PH, and just a bit of history lesson, the PH comes from years and years ago. It's kind of an homage to hackers used to use phones, as in PH, to get free phone calls. So that's what that's all about, the phishing for information. And it comes in various guises. So it can be via a phone, somebody ringing you up. They sometimes call that phishing, as in voice, but that's phone scam. Somebody rings up, usually pretending to be somebody in authority. A text message, which is really, really easy. As far as a hacker is concerned, it's really, really easy to spoof a text message so that it looks like it's from, let's say, the bank. Now, mobile phone providers are trying to ensure that they reduce the number of phishing texts that come through. It's so easy because it actually is done by 2G, and most phones are 2G compliant. Social media, again, luring you into entering some details. And the classic is emails. So what they want to achieve in phishing is they either want to take you to a fake website, or they want you to download, they call it a payload, as in a bomb, a file, or click on something. Now, before you even realize you've clicked on something, and in the background, it's downloading and entering something malicious onto your systems. And that's I don't know what the statistics are, but the vast majority of cases of how ransomware gets into organizations is via phishing. One of the biggest risks to all businesses and law firms at the moment are actually the employees, the people in the organization. You can have your super fantastic, you know, all singing, all dancing firewalls. You know, we call it magic tech that will stop it all AI, you know, yeah, no, nothing can penetrate that. Yeah, okay. And then some clown clicks on a link in your organization, and before you know it, they've downloaded something and all your files are encrypted. So a lot of phishing is using very sophisticated behavioral psychology and social engineering. And usually when you receive, and they're getting more and more sophisticated, you receive, let's say, an email or a phone call, it purports to be somebody in authority, so the police or HMRC. There's urgency. Oh, you must do this quickly, you know, limited amount of time to claim a refund or... there's usually emotion attached to it. So recently with COVID, lack of PPE, you know, quickly before we've only got so many boxes left. Scarcity and current events. So you tend to find there's a flurry of emails after the tax year, for example, HMRC emails. And with COVID, there's been, I mean, the COVID-related cybercrime increased 400%. Now, that's a bit of a misnomer, that 400%, because February 2020. There was no COVID, and that was, it went up like that, obviously. But yeah, they will try and lure you into click on something, and don't think, oh, you know what? I'm not that stupid. I would never click on that link. They are so sophisticated. I'm in this game, okay? And I got an email the other day, looked like it was from PayPal, and it said, don't forget to spend your credit. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, have I got credit? And I went to click on, I thought, whoa, no, hang on a second. It was a spoof one. So fortunately I didn't. But that's how ransomware gets into your organizations. That's the number one way. So what do you do if you become a victim? Well, the first thing to do would be to, you could bring action fraud. Now, there are some positive, negative views on action fraud. To be perfectly honest, when you do register with action fraud, they're not potential, they will try and help you, but they may not be able to help you. And it would just be a case of logging it so you can claim on your insurance. Contact the police. No, but you need to contact the right departments, because I've known of examples where organizations have wanted to brush a cyber attack under the carpet. So they've, you know, contacted the, you know, the local police station, have gone, I don't know, instead of, you know, the cyber units. The bank, if it's a bank, you've done something with the bank, and the insurers, you need to make sure you contact your insurers. What's happening with the government is, the government, like I said, have been ploughing lots of money into educating individuals on and businesses on cybercrime, and they've set up in each a number of areas these cyber resilience centres. We're actually a preferred supplier, and they're really, really good. So they dovetail off of the National Cyber Security Centre. And they have lots of free training. They have lots of advice. If you were to get attacked, they didn't know what to do. If you give them a ring, they'll be able to point you in the direction of forensic organisations that will hopefully be able to help you try and recover some of your data. And in some instances, they may even have decryption keys to unencrypt the data. But prevention, I'm afraid it's prevention is better than cure. So after the horse is bolted, and I'm speaking to the police that work with Manchester Cyber Resilience Centre, and I said, okay, so what's the threshold if, you know, we transfer some money or some money gets taken, invoice hijacking, what's the threshold? And the answer is, well, there isn't one. Okay, it's whether it's solvability. In other words, if we got a relationship with a country, because money usually tends to get very rapidly sent abroad, have we got a relationship with that country where we can recover it? Also, you tend to find a lot of cybercrime is when the police do investigate it, they find that it's originated in a country outside of this jurisdiction, and the view is it's not in the public interest to pursue it. So what's the likelihood of us actually convicting somebody? The statistics are 1% of organisations report cybercrime. Of that 1%, only 1% is solved. So, you know, those aren't very high statistics. However, we are trying really hard with the prevention piece. So how can you bolster yourself to make sure that you personally and your law firm doesn't become victim to a cyber attack? Passwords. I know it sounds simple, but the number one way of getting access to a system is to guess somebody's passwords. And you can do that by actually guessing, by collecting information on somebody, looking at their social media, or actually using tools to hack in. So the National Cyber Security Centre recommend, you know, three words using alphanumeric characters, and the longer, so sort of 8 to 12 characters, the longer the password, the harder it is to crack. And that's just a numbers game. Make sure you enable where you have it, two-factor authentication. Like I said, that's where you get a password, a username, a password, and then some other mechanism to log you in. And it's usually you get a text message, or you have like a little token on an app, or your fingerprint, or a pattern that you draw on your phone. Make sure that those are enabled. And if anybody does ring up, don't disclose that. No matter how convincing they are, do not disclose any of those PINs. A couple of reasons. One, because the number one reason is bank, then you could invalidate the terms and conditions, and they won't pay out, basically. Make sure your software patches are up to date, so have everything set to auto. Make sure you've got antivirus, the latest up to virus. The clue's in the word, it's antivirus, so it's stopping viruses getting into onto your system. So if there's a vulnerability with, let's say, the latest version of Windows, and they've found that, you know, there's a backdoor way into a system, then making your antivirus up to date will make sure that it's aware of that vulnerability and shut that door, so to speak. we must make sure that you do regular backups of all your key data. Now, you need to make sure that it's what's called air-gapped. So you need to make sure that it's not, you know, on the same network. So cloud's a great way to back stuff up. Just make sure it's separate. So either a separate drive, a physically separate drive, so that it's not on the system on an extra drive, because unfortunately, like I said, what's happening at the moment is cyber criminals are getting in and encrypting everything, including backups. If you do end up in the middle of an attack, the thing to do is just unplug everything, you know, literally wipe those systems and restore from backup, but you need the backup to start with. You need to be really careful working from home. Make sure using a virtual private networks, encrypt the data. Don't lose your USB sticks, and make sure everybody only has access to the data that they're meant to. There's lots of certifications that law firms and businesses can do. There's a range of ISO certifications, and you can also have your company penetration tested and vulnerability scanned. So just explain what that means, because people talk, say it's pen test. You think, what does that mean? And then say penetration, you go, oh, that sounds a bit of a rude word, but it's not. What it means is vulnerability scanning. The analogy is like somebody walking around a house, a burglar, walking around a house and just looking to see if there's an open window or an open door, but not doing anything else, just saying, by the way, you've got an open window, you've got an open door. A penetration test is where we've found that vulnerability and we're going through the door. We're not breaking anything else. We're not kind of trying to smash windows. We're just opening that door that's unlocked, and walking in and seeing how far we can get in. So if it was your house, you'd see how far you could get in, let's say, to the jewelry box, okay? And then what would happen is you get a report from the penetration test to say, you know, by the way, that port's open, which means I can get access. So one of the most common attacks that were happening in throughout COVID, everybody had to get home quickly, get home, get your laptop, off you go. Now there's a port. Now ports in computer speak are basically, think of them like doors, and they allow you in and out. So you have ports to connect to the internet and so on and so forth. And one of the ports that is on your system is called a remote desktop protocol. So, you know, when you ring your help desk, and they say, oh, okay, can I just take control of your system? And you're sat there, and by magic, they start, you know, the mouse goes along the screen and they start fixing things and opening things and typing stuff in and fixing your machine. And that's great in a help desk situation. It isn't great if you're working at home and a hacker realizes that on your organization that port's open and they get in that way. Okay, so what a penetration test would do, well, a vulnerability scan and then ultimately a penetration test will say, whoa, hang on a second, you're not using RDP, you need to shut that door and keep it locked. So that's an example of when a pen test is really, really useful. You need to make sure your firewalls are on and configured. The firewalls is a bit like a doorman, letting things in and out. And you can have what are called access lists to allow certain websites to, you're allowed to access certain websites and you're allowed certain data to go in and out, and they can be configured. Now, in terms of everything else, then it's analysing the risk. So in terms of risk, we could offset that risk. We can transfer that risk to insurance. So a lot of insurers these days do have cyber elements to their policy, throughout Hiscox and so on, but they may ask to ensure that you're in quite good health to start with before they'll insure you. But yeah, you need to make sure you need all of those things in place. And real, it's all dead simple stuff. On the screen, you can see I've got the National Cyber Security Centre. It's useful to get Cyber Essentials. So I'm a Cyber Essentials assessor. It's £300. You go through a questionnaire, and then hopefully if you pass, then you get the certificate you can put on your website. And it just demonstrates to your clients that you take cyber security very seriously. And it's all the simple things: passwords, admin access, security, access control, and patches, all of the basic things that really just makes you think about cybersecurity. And like I said, the resilience centres have been set up all over the country. And there is also something called a cyber alarm. And again, if you go onto the National Cyber Security Centre, you can register for that. And it's a bit like a CCTV alarm type service that you can sign up to. So it will notify you of the types of cybercrime that are going on. And then the last thing is train your staff. You know, constantly keep training your staff. If there are new types of cyber attacks out there, they need to be aware so that they don't click on the link or download something or whatever that might be. So that's the types of cybercrime we've got. So from a legal perspective, where does this all fit? Okay, well, cybercrime falls into two areas. Firstly, cyber-dependent crime. So this is where the computer, because it still refers to the computer, is a tool for committing and targeting the crime. So an example of that is hacking, or what's called a DDoS, denial of service attack. What a DDoS attack is a distributed denial of service attack. What that means is it's basically bombarding a website with too many requests it can't cope with, and it falls over. Okay, so that's basically what it is, but you can actually DDoS each other on games and so on. Now, cyber-enabled crime is where we've taken traditional crimes and they've gone online. Okay, so things like, they're called economic-related cybercrime. So fraud, you know, selling fraudulent goods or acting fraudulently, online marketplace for illegal items. So there's in terms of the marketplace, as in Facebook marketplace could be an example, but there are also, when you go onto the dark web, now the dark web isn't the color dark, it just means that it's evil. And there are lots of they look like eBay. You go on them, they look like eBay, except down the left-hand side where you know you've got all the categories, it's got guns, passports, and you know you can get somebody bumped off for 10,000 euros, you know, drugs. And then you expand it and it's got all the ratings. Unbelievable. Social media, so trolling and cyberbullying. Now, there was a paper came out a couple of weeks ago backed by Cameron, and it's a paper that they're backing to make a law specifically for things like online abuse. So keep an eye on that. That will be coming down. It's currently just been released as a paper. And also a lot of the online type personal, the trolling and the stalking, a lot of that has also gone into the domestic abuse bill. I don't know if anybody's had a chance to look at that. So we're taking all of these traditional physical crimes and putting them, and they've been woven into lots of other different laws. And obviously crimes against children, which is just, you know, awful, 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 awful. I went to do some work for Preston Police Station, and they were showing me where detectives have to sit and read through or see all of this really traumatic material. And next door was like a quiet room with lovely coffee and things, just because it was so traumatic. Just as an aside to that, the government recognised that, you know, there's some really pretty horrific things out there. And GCHQ, which is, you know, MI5, have embraced artificial intelligence so that we can keep a handle on this. And also that there's a bit of confusion with artificial intelligence. There's a misconception that it's sort of a lot of people see it as like this Hollywood robots walking down the road and taking over the world. The reality is it's actually a machine that's been taught to go and look for something and then report that back. So in the example of the sexual offences and things like child pornography, GCHQ are using artificial intelligence to penetrate things like online grooming forums, those types of forums, because the software can process, AI can process, you know, what would take a human being potentially years of surveillance and look at that very quickly and look at the signs it's been taught to look for and report back and say, I think you need to look into this. So GCHQ are really embracing artificial intelligence to try and get on top of cyber-enabled crime. If you're interested in the types of offences, I've put a link there, which I can share with just the CPS website, which has got guidance on prosecutions for that, for cyber crime. So what laws have we got? Well, we've got the Computer Misuse Act, which 1990 probably could do with a bit of an update, and the Communications Act. Now, because the Computer Misuse Act, like I said, is relates for more so for sort of cyber-dependent crimes, what you tend to find is that any other of those cyber crimes, which would be traditional, we then take traditional laws and sort of they come into the pot, so to speak. So other laws that would be considered would be fraud, process of crime, serious crime, patents, trademarks, obviously data protection. And those of you that joined last time, as Sally was saying, is sometimes you can use those other laws as negotiations with somebody being prosecuted because the sentences might have lesser sentences. So a lot of the times when you see people who have been prosecuted under, so we can use those as negotiations sometimes for, you tend to find when you look at anybody who has been prosecuted, it'd be like, you know, Computer Misuse Act, Data Protection Act, maybe, you know, proceeds of crime and so on. So there's a whole, not necessarily just one law that gets introduced. So looking just at the Computer Misuse Act, it's broken down into four areas. And hopefully you can see this. I can annotate my section one, unauthorized access to computer material. Examples of that is shoulder surfing and using somebody's password to access an account. Up to 2 years. Now, what's really interesting is when we're talking about types of people that do these crimes, I was chatting to the police and I said, okay, so are many women, do many women commit these offences? And it was really interesting because the offences that tend to be a bit more emotional. So an example would be, you know, it's an offence under section one to log in with your ex-boyfriend's account to see pictures of his new girlfriend, you know, on Facebook. So that is actually an offence. And that tends to be women. Women tend to be involved in that more so than men. And the hacking and the, you know, the ransomware tends to be more male oriented. Now, it says they're 2 years, but what the police were saying was that because a lot of the times somebody has been caught committing these offences, it's usually they've never done anything before and they weren't aware, although obviously we know that's not a defence, that I wasn't aware that that was I thought it was morally wrong. I didn't think it was legally wrong. It tends to be what the answer that you get. That they tend to be given a warning or, you know, if it goes that far, then suspended sentences. But on the whole, it tends to not really go very far. So that's why it looks like the rates of prosecution are quite low. And that's because the people that are committing these types of things either don't know what they're doing, and those that are big fish. So the section two, unauthorized access with intent to commit or facilitate commission of a further crime. So without their permission, you access friend's phone and transfer money from their account. Take 5 years in prison, up to 5 years. Unauthorized acts with intent to impair or with recklessness as to impair operating a computer. So DDoSing somebody off a game, potentially up to 10 years in prison. And then, make that a bit smaller. Unauthorized acts causing or breaking or risk of serious damage. That's hacking into a government system. You can get up to life potentially. And making, supplying or obtaining articles for use as another offence. Up to 2 years. So you tend to get a lot of kids hacking into their school systems. Now, interestingly, I was speaking to somebody earlier this morning about this, and the police have recognised that a lot of kids who, you know, hack into their school systems, again, may not be aware that actually it's an offence. And rather than, it's not in the public interest for them to, you know, lock these kids up in centres. So they actually try to channel that and retrain them, because we do need these people at GCHQ becoming a white hat hacker and channeling that. So there is a huge program with Manchester Cyber Resilience Centre to actually, you know, get these offenders or potential offenders and saying, right, okay, yeah, you're in trouble, but, you know, we'll kind of let you off if you go on this rehab program, and then they can channel that into something more constructive, because we do need. One thing which is really interesting is that these kids that do get caught, they don't realize how good they are, and we need really good people. So it's trying to persuade them to walk onto the right side of the law, and that's something that the police are taking really seriously. Okay, so what I've got here is there's a website I can share with you to give you an idea of the types of prosecutions when people do get before a judge, what they're looking at. So this particular individual in January this year, they were done for section one of the Computer Misuse Act. It was a teenager who mail-bombed his employee 55 folders and 2009 and 26 files. kid had ADHD, sentenced to 9 months suspended for 2 years and 200 hours of unpaid work. The ICO versus Kim Doyle, William Shaw, Manchester in January, Computer Misuse Act. Kim Doyle, 33, accessed RSU's computer system and transferred personal data to members' road traffic accidents by emailing it to William Shaw, a director of a claims management company. Yeah, that happens. Believe it or not, that happens a lot. So one of the big problems at the moment, cybercrime stroke data theft, is grooming young influential kids to go and work on help desks to obtain data, like as was happening here. She was actually emailing it to herself. But, you know, that's why some of the help desks I've been, there was a company that did reassess your electricity bills, and they confiscated people's phones. And I was out in the morning, I was like, why? And they said, because they don't want them to take photos of the screen. Okay, they were suspended for 2 years in order to do 100 hours unpaid work and £1,000 each of cost. Doyle ordered to pay £25,000 and £15,000 proceeds of crime. Gosh, interesting. This one, Akash Sondi, Regina Akash Sondi. 4 years, a former civil servant, hacked into social media accounts, Snapchat, of 574 girls and young women to obtain intimate pictures. He then blackmailed them. Oh, dear. I've heard that as well in a school near here. Something similar happened.
It's a really good case, Emma. I'll come to it at the end. It's a really good case because you see also he was indicted with voyeurism as well.
Ah,
yeah. Which you would never call voyeurism, yeah, with cybercrime, would you? But it's just clever ways of charging and indicting people with the law. Sorry to interrupt you. I'd like to carry on.
Tell us more. And the last one I just snapshotted, Scott was senior prime, specialised in domestic, what? A senior prime, specialised in domestic violence cases, used CPS computers. What an idiot. To find information about his ex-wife's new, but there you go, and divorce proceedings. Oh, my God. But I didn't read these before. That's why they're new to me, too. A sentence, 20 weeks suspended for 18 months, 100 hours unpaid work, and 20 days rehab. Restraining order. Yeah. I'm not kidding.
He's actually been struck off now. Some of you will, I don't want to reveal anything, but he certainly isn't practicing anymore. And obviously lots of CPS lawyers are very decent and proper and hardworking, but yeah. That's also, you know, if you are a saddo, you know, it's really good bedtime reading some of these cases, like I am. Really, yeah, it's quite an interesting case.
So yeah, so those are just, so I pulled off of a site that I'm happy I can share with you all, specific to Computer Misuse Act offences, because I wanted to bring. And as you can see, when you look at the volumes of cybercrime that you hear about versus the prosecutions, you know, it's not that many compared to how many people have their systems encrypted and so on. So like I keep saying, prevention's better than cure. So I think those of you who came on the last webinar, I mentioned this before, I'm going to talk about it again because it's really, really relevant. So if you are a victim of cybercrime, well, who's to blame? You know, is your business, who is to blame? Is it the fault of the person you've been dealing with, or, you know, who can we blame? So in this example, there's a constable painting. So this constable painting was, there was an art dealer in London and he loaned the painting to an art gallery in the Netherlands. And then the art gallery in the Netherlands said, oh, we'd like to buy it, please. And they negotiated a price, who they believed was the seller, for £2.4 million. So the art gallery in the Netherlands transferred £2.4 million. And guess what? It went off to an account in Hong Kong. And I suppose if you received an invoice and you're an art dealer, an art gallery, to pay Hong Kong, might not even bat an eyelid. And so then the art dealer went, well, hang on a second. You've not paid me for the painting. And so what happened was the art gallery in the Netherlands thought they were dealing with the dealer in London. And the dealer in London had his emails hacked and the invoice changed. so that when the gallery in the Netherlands paid what they believed to be the invoice of the dealer, it wasn't for somebody else. Okay. So the dealer's saying, okay, my systems were hacked, but you've paid all that money and now I don't have a painting. And the gallery, I said, well, hang on a second. You know, we own this painting because we've paid. The fact that your systems were hacked is not my fault. It's not our fault. You should have had, you know, better cybersecurity. So it's kind of like, where's the duty of care? And that's actually rumbling through the courts at the moment, because the art gallery said, well, actually, we now own this painting. They brought a case against the dealer and that didn't go anywhere. And they're waiting for another hearing. So because the dealer said, well, give me the painting back so I can at least sell it and get some money back. But the gallery have said no. So it's sat in some art gallery in the Netherlands. And the dealer in the UK is currently out of pocket. He's got no money and no painting. But whose fault is it? Whose fault? And the reality is there isn't any law about that. And that's what we need kind of addressing. Is it the fault of the dealer because his cybersecurity was rubbish? Is it the fault of the gallery because they didn't do their due diligence? I mean, if somebody, I say this often and the police say this often, that if you're paying, potentially going to be paying a large amount of money or even a small amount of money to somebody that you've never paid any money to before, then it would be a good idea to just transfer a very small amount of pound, you know, or even £10 or something, and just get them to confirm the other end that they've received that money before you transfer any more. So you need due diligence on. So whose fault is it? Well, we don't really know because there isn't anything that, and no case law for this. But this happens all the time. It happens all the time. Invoice hijacking in businesses. Somebody's got into the email and doctor's invoices. And, you know, we know of one where they lost £250,000. So it happens a lot. It's actually originated in conveyancing a few years ago, where, you know, somebody received an invoice, they thought, oh, okay, that's the bank details of the solicitors, and they transferred the money and it's gone. Gone. What do you do? Well, not a lot really. Because, I mean, you'll notice now when you go into the bank, when online, that they ask loads of questions. Are you absolutely sure you want to transfer this? Is this the right account? And so on. So usually, sometimes when there is I'm just going to briefly mention this before just as we wrap up. So one thing that we get asked a lot is, so if there's a cyber attack, okay, on a company, they don't actually have to necessarily tell anybody, well, they don't have to tell anybody that there's been a cyber crime, but they would have to say something if personal data had been breached. So one of the ways that individuals are bringing claims against businesses is by saying, well, hang on a second, my personal data was stolen. And the reason they know their data was stolen is because they will have received an email. I received one the other week from Total Fitness to say, we've had a cyber attack, but don't worry, your data's fine. Well, why are you telling me? You're telling me because you've got to tell me, because under the GDPR, it says that you must report it to the individuals where they are at high risk. So therefore, I know that there's been my personal data has been stolen. So that is how the companies out there that are encouraging individuals to bring claims against companies where there's been a breach of the GDPR, and usually because their personal data has gone awry, and they know about this because they've had to be told. Hence the reason there's a big class action group litigation order against British Airways. They had a cyber attack in 2018 where they had some code on their website that hadn't been tested properly, and they were attacked, and people were routed to a fake payment site and not entered in all their details, and 500,000 transactions were compromised. And so there's been a group litigation brought for those individuals to bring claims against British Airways. And whenever there is a big cyber attack, a big breach in some way, then they're scrambling at the moment to get these group litigation orders. We're going to have to see how they pan out, because I haven't seen one yet. I have to see how it pans out, how much somebody's entitled to. So it's a contravention of the GDPR, not just the data breach. But under the Data Protection Act 2018, you can sue for material or non-material loss, including distress. So how much are these claims worth? Well, not that much. And at the moment, not that much. And because it's under £10,000, the distress is not a personal injury, then it's small claims. So it's, you know, up to take. Now, any anybody who would say, yes, bring a claim against a company will say, oh, yeah, yeah, we can. It's worth over £10,000 because obviously they want to get their costs. And the reality is there's only limited numbers of claims that I'm aware of where they've actually been over £10,000. And they've been pretty serious, usually for things like medical data. But there's some examples there of the types of claims that have been brought for types of compensation for data breaches. The ones that we tend to defend, because we defend quite a lot of these claims that come in from people, is where, you know, some data's got lost in the post or, you know, sent somewhere else and they're just looking for a couple of grand. But obviously, it still costs the company that you're defending, because obviously there's fees on top of that. So in terms of how much of these claims were, there's some case law there. The one that I would keep your eye on at the bottom is Lloyd versus Google. He claimed that Google had lost control of somebody's data and about £750 will make me feel better. And what's happening at the moment is that you'll tend to find the majority of websites, the cookie banners and their cookies have been dropped down on your machine without you consenting, because under the Privacy and Electronic Communication Regulation, cookie consent for tracking cookies, it's GDPR consent. Yes, I do want them dropping down onto my machine. And people don't really understand how it works. So cookies have been plopped down on people's machines, and anybody who's aware of this this case is writing to drop these non-functional cookies down on machine. I didn't consent to it, but I will accept £750. Now that's going to be heard again. It's been up through the courts in the next couple of months. So we'll see whether that stands. But at the moment, people are bringing claims for cookies that have been dropped down on people's machines for, like I said, £750. Okay, so that's me and John, Cyber Data Protection Legal. We do training, consultancy, legal service, cyber essentials, and we're a trusted supplier. So if you're kind of in a quandary, you don't know what to do, you've been a cyber attack or a data breach, or you think, oh my God, what do we do? Just think, the Greens will know. Emma and John Green will know. And if we don't know, we'll know somebody who will. So does anybody have any questions?
Hi, Emma. Firstly, thank you. That was really good. Normally get everyone to do a virtual clap, which is great. There are two questions in the chat, but just very quickly, if I can ask my own questions, if you like. Obviously, I know a lot about this area, so they're kind of generic, if you like, for the audience. I think I've written them in there, have I? Let me just remind myself. The first thing really I wanted to ask Emma was this, that, yeah, here we are. I've said three questions. One, crossover with areas of law that I see and the police. Second point was about prevention and insurers paying out. And the third question was about terms and conditions of social media. And then I think Catherine, the student's got a question about glamorizing of hackers being cool, whether they're press students. Well, that's just a question about opinions, a matter of opinion. And then there's another question in there. So just taking my questions really about crossover. People see cybersecurity as this specialist, niche, nuanced area, don't they? But it crops up all over the place. So I just wondered if, as we've seen from your notes, but, you know, from domestic violence to, you know, revenge crime, to pornography, to voyeurism. So my question is about, do you see that being an ongoing trend where it's not just, you know, a breach in a school or a specific commercial issue has arisen from the painting case, for example, which then goes into a whole area of data and cyber breach? Do you see there being more crossovers? I can give my own opinion, but do you see there being more crossovers to different areas? You know, coroner's court, you need access to see what materials the deceased was looking at before they took their own life, if in fact they did take their own life, or whether it was as a result of some other cause of distress and so on and so forth. So I get drafted in there. Do you see that being the case everywhere, that there's an ever expanding?
Definitely, because more and more things are going electronic. So more and more things are online, and whatever the motivation for that the hacker may be, I mean, attacking all these schools, these primary schools, and that they have been recently all over the country. Yeah. Why are they doing that? Well, the one argument, it can be financial gain, because the other may be that it's state sponsored, and that another state is trying to assess our capabilities or even obtain information about population. So I think that whatever the motive, it depends on the motivation, but I think, yeah, more and more is online, and somebody will find a way of being able to exploit something that you've got that they want. And that's really all it boils down to.
Yeah. And then what about sort of my two questions, and we'll come to Catherine's question in a minute, which is really about prevention issue is much more important, and insurers. You know, I often talk about the credit card terms. If you haven't got secure terms, and you know, then the fraud occurs, they just won't reimburse you and won't pay you back. So just where are you at with that? If prevention, I always say, is better than the cure.
Prevention without doubt, because you know, but the problem with cybercrime is that it's very much horses bolted. It's very difficult to persuade board members to say, right, okay, you need to spend this amount of money, because there's no tangible benefit to them. They're like, well, why are we spending it? It might never happen. Yeah, but it might. So it's obviously assessment of risk. What is it we want to keep secure? What is it at the heart of our business? It might be IP, it might be whatever it might be. But it's very difficult to persuade billboards to spend big amounts of money on, let's say, training their staff not to click on links, for example, because they can't see any immediate tangible benefit. Funny enough, they suddenly find the money, everything's encrypted, and the business isn't working. Now, in terms of insurance, then that's, you know, assessing the risk. We've assessed the risk. We're not going to put certain things in place, but we're going to try and, you know, transfer that risk to an insurer or transfer that risk to cloud. Which is what happens a lot of the time. But you need to be quite careful, because in the, you know, we all know that, no offence to anybody who works in insurance, which don't you do here, but is that insurers will do their best not to pay out.
Yes. So
you've got to kind of, and it's Claire, isn't it, that does risk. You've got to assess that risk. You need to look at the environment, look at what it is you want to maintain and keep secure, and say, okay, what are we prepared to accept? What are we going to transfer that risk out? What are we going to write off, and how long can we stand being down offline, you know, as a business, for reputation and for, you know, financially? How long can we avoid our systems to be offline? Are we just going to back everything up, and if it goes wrong, we'll just restore from backup? So it's a case of looking at an entire environment and assessing what cybersecurity things are put in place.
Yeah, and I suppose I noticed Catherine, who arrived late, has introduced herself as somebody who advising boards. It's important for boards, as you say, Emma, to get on board, even in a non-exec role. It's more important now than ever to make sure the boards understand, so that the execs, who are the people more likely to either commit it or be not as on top of it, if you like, are fully engaged to avoid it. So the final question for me was just about terms and conditions on social media, but we've got a separate webinar that I'm giving with you on that. So we can deal with that there, really. Just a reminder about people's consent to certain use of social media and so on. What do you think about this question from Catherine, which is, where does she say? Yeah, she says, question, do you think the media glamorized hacking, especially in youth, e.g. Criminal Minds, Spider-Man, where in TV and films, hacking is almost encouraged as is cool or impressive? Thank you. I haven't seen those. I'm probably too old now.
I think that it's just one element of it. For young, does it make it appeal to young kids? Well, yeah, but you may find that kids are more sort of the digital divide is narrower than when we were kids. You know, they've completely, this is part of their DNA. So being able to DDoS their mates on the Xbox, I think does it glamorize it? Well, yeah, but I think that's why a lot of education, there needs to be more education on explaining to kids, look, you can't just hack into the school systems and bring them down. I think that it attracts certain types of kids who are interested, and kids from certain backgrounds. One thing that's happening a lot is kids are being groomed on the likes of things like Xboxes to partake in things like hacking. So I think it really depends on the on the child, to be honest, but they've grown up with this. Is there going to be more of it? Well, yes and no. I mean, it depends on whether they know that what they're doing is wrong. And I think if they're trying to, you know, guess people's passwords, hopefully their moral compass will tell them that it's wrong. So I think it really does depend. But that's yes. just one element, because we've got, you know, organized crime. We've got, you know, state crime. There's a whole plethora of it.
Well, interesting. And then the final thing, Emma, is the comment from Lindsay. Oh, hi, Lindsay. Who's saying that about football transfer fees and court settlement money has been misdirected in these ways that people, you know, often would not even link football, would they, with cybercrime and security, that there's been a lot of that going on recently where the transfer monies have gone miscellaneous.
Yeah, it comes down to, if you receive an invoice from somebody, a new invoice for somebody you've never paid, then you need to do some due diligence on them. Ring the person that you know, not the number on the invoice. And if anybody sends you an invoice to say that our bank details have changed, then again, do the same thing, because there may be a valid reason. You know, everybody was changing the banks during COVID because they were offering 1,200 quid, I think it was, to transfer to, if you move your business account to them, they'd give you a 1,200 quid. So there might be a valid reason for it. But it's about due diligence on the side of the person paying that invoice to check that it is who it's meant to be from. So,
yeah, absolutely. Now, we've got over 2 o'clock. Are there any final burning questions? I can't see them in there. I don't know if you want to have a quick look in the chat. If not, Emma can be contacted on LinkedIn. She's very nice. I prefer people to, if they want to connect with me, to send a message. You all know that as to where we've met, because I don't know. And also, you're on Twitter, I think, Emma, aren't you?
Yes, I'm on LinkedIn too. So on your LinkedIn. If we're not friends, we can be friends soon.
Yeah, no, definitely. And the I can't remember the date for our next cybersecurity specific webinar at all. I need to try and remember it. But there's a whole range, cybersecurity for HR, cybersecurity, as I said at the beginning. So people can go on Women in Law UK website and find out when it's next coming up. Is that all right?
Yes. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for coming, guys. Ladies, rather.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes, I know. We all say that. My children all say guys. So I start saying guys, even to girls. So brilliant. Thank you, everyone. I think that's really great. And I hope that was useful. Oh, Caroline stayed on beyond 2 o'clock. Brilliant. Yeah, okay. Excellent. Are there any burning questions? I can't hear. Good.
You enjoy the rest of the holiday.
Yes, I shall try. I have to go. My clerks are already ringing me to say, can you help out?
Yeah, okay.